This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website for download via iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, you can send a message through the chat option available with GoToWebinar. We want to thank the sponsor of this month's podcast, Alexion. Alexion is a global biopharmaceutical company focused on serving patients with severe and rare disorders through their innovation, development, and commercialization of life-transforming therapeutic products. Their goal to deliver medical breakthroughs where none currently exist is driven by the knowledge that people's lives depend on their work. For today's podcast, we are pleased to be joined by Dr. Michael Levy and Maureen Mealy. Maureen Mealy is a clinical program manager at Johns Hopkins Transverse Myelitis Center and Neuromyelitis Optica Clinic in Baltimore, Maryland. Maureen is a certified clinical neuroscience registered nurse and a multiple sclerosis certified nurse. She has longstanding experience in neurosciences as she began her nursing career in the neurosciences critical care unit at the Johns Hopkins Hospital and later joined the Johns Hopkins Multiple Sclerosis, Transverse Myelitis, and Encephalitis Centers in January of 2007. Ms. Mealy then moved to Dallas along with Dr. Benjamin Greenberg, former co-director of the Johns Hopkins Transverse Myelitis Center, to establish the Transverse Myelitis and Neuromyelitis Optica Program at the University of Texas Southwestern University in Pediatric Demyelinating Disorders at Children's Medical Center of Dallas in January of 2009. More recently, Ms. Mealy rejoined Johns Hopkins and teamed up with Drs. Carlos Pardo and Dr. Michael Levy, where she currently acts as the program manager, clinical research coordinator, and senior nurse of the Transverse Myelitis Center and Neuromyelitis Optica Clinic. Dr. Michael Levy is an associate professor of neurology and the medical director of general neurology at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Levy specializes in taking care of patients with neuroimmunologic diseases, including multiple sclerosis, transverse myelitis, optic neuritis, and neuromyelitis optica. In the laboratory, Dr. Levy's research focus is on the development of neural stems for regenerative therapy in these diseases. He uses rat and mouse models to test the survival, differentiation, and functional capacity of human neural stem cells to improve neurologic function in post-inflammatory conditions. The goal of his laboratory and clinical effort is to translate the basic science stem cell work to a human trial in transverse myelitis and other neuroimmunologic diseases. Welcome and thank you both very much for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Happy to be here.
Thank you. So just to start, before we jump into the questions, Dr. Levy, would you mind just giving an overview of neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, presentation and treatment options?
Neuromyelitis optica, or NMO, as we say in shorthand, is an autoimmune condition in which the immune system abnormally targets the optic nerves and spinal cord of patients. In the attack of the optic nerve, it can cause blindness. And in the attack of the spinal cord, it can cause weakness, numbness, and bowel and bladder dysfunction. The attacks tend to occur sporadically, and they remit with treatment. And some patients make some recovery. There's usually some disability left behind. And over the long term, patients with NMO can accumulate disabilities that can persist for years, and those include pain and difficulty walking and weakness with bowel bladder dysfunction. And we have treatments for both the attacks, that's usually steroids and plasma exchange, and we also have preventive treatments to try to reduce the chance of a relapse. And most patients are on just a handful of medications. Probably the most popular are Rituxan and Cellcept. And there's always questions surrounding how we use those medications, but when used correctly, the risk of a relapse drops about 75 or 80%. So we have good medications and for both on the preventive side and on the treatment side. We don't have good treatments for spinal cord injury. So after the attack is done, and patients are on a treatment to prevent the next attack, they're still suffering from the damage that was already done. And so we're working to try to repair the spinal cord using whatever means we have, including stem cells.
Okay, great. Thank you. And, you know, so, you know, in terms of, you know, the potential causes of NMO, we did get some questions about, for example, there was a question about, you know, the Mirena IUD, which causes, you know, spinal fluid pressure, and they're saying that there's some reports of that, or, you know, non-rashing shingles virus, for example. Do we know of any potential causes of NMO, or anything that can kind of, something's happened before the diagnosis?
Yeah, that's a great question. We know that we don't know exactly what causes NMO, what starts off the whole disease, what triggers the immune system to turn on itself. We don't know the answer to that. There's certainly a combination of genetic predispositions and environmental insults that combine to cause the disease. We know that there are certain triggers of attacks. So for example, the non-rashing shingles virus that's caused by the varicella zoster virus, which causes chickenpox in childhood and then lives in your nerves throughout adulthood. And when it retrogradely transports into the spinal fluid, it can cause an infection in the central nervous system, and that certainly can trigger an attack of NMO. And you wouldn't notice that on the skin, because the virus can either go out towards the skin or it can go in towards the brain. When it goes in towards the brain, it can trigger a relapse. It's not that the virus itself causes the disease, it just triggers a relapse. So basically anything that stimulates the immune system can also trigger a relapse. The goal of treatment is to try to keep the immune system from overactivating, from remaining, we try to keep the immune system to remain calm. And that we feel like is the best approach to preventing attacks.
Okay, and then is there any evidence that any sort of complementary approaches are helpful in the management of NMO, you know, like naturopathy or acupuncture or anything like that?
There really isn't a lot of data in NMO. And so we can extrapolate from other diseases like spinal cord injury and multiple sclerosis, which have many more trials that have been tested. And mostly those approaches, the homeopathic approaches, help with symptom management more than necessarily with the autoimmune process that's going on for the disease itself. And so we know from spinal cord injury and from MS that there are some homeopathic things that seem to be helpful for pain, for example. Cognitive behavioral therapy and exercise therapy are among the most helpful if you look at all the literature, but there's definitely a lot of conflicting literature for a lot of the approaches as well. So it hasn't been parsed out very well, at least here in our Western World Medication Society, but I think that it's definitely something that's being more largely widely looked at, because we have found that medications alone aren't always the answer and that adjunctive therapies might be helpful.
And I would just add that in my experience in the clinic, it tends to be very individualized. Some patients respond well to certain diets and to certain complementary approaches, and some patients don't. My feeling on it is that it doesn't necessarily cause any harm. And so as long as it's not too expensive or too inconvenient to try it, I always encourage my patients to try different non-medical approaches to dealing with symptoms.
Okay, and you briefly mentioned, you know, about, you know, diet and stuff. Are there any, is there any goal of diet, you know, doing some sort of modification, you know, in NMO, for example, there's some, you know, autoimmune diets out there that are promoted for example, MS. Is there any research or information on that in NMO?
Not specifically for NMO, but the idea behind a diet for autoimmune disease is that there are certain foods that can trigger the immune system in the gut. And when the immune system in the gut is activated, it can translocate into the nervous system and cause a relapse. It's theoretical at this point. It is rational. It makes sense. And some patients have linked their diets to relapses. It hasn't been scientifically studied. But we know, for example, with some diseases like gluten sensitivity, that there is an immune reaction to the things that you eat. So while we don't have any specific recommendations, I listen to my patients, and if they tell me that they are sensitive to certain foods, whether it's gluten or lactose or whatever it is they feel like they're sensitive to, I think it's reasonable to try to avoid these foods and try to limit the amount of immune activation as in response to a certain diet. That's very reasonable to me. I wouldn't go too far with that and promote any specific diet, but I think it could be individualized depending on every individual's reaction to certain diets.
Right, that makes sense. So, you know, being in contact with your healthcare provider about what you think works and doesn't work. And then we got a few questions about the specific treatments for NMO. For example, azathioprine. So, I know you mentioned some of the other medications like Rituxan and Cellcept, but what do we know about the other medications? And this person in particular asked if it's safe at some point to reduce the dose of this medication or even stop taking it.
Well, what we know about NMO is that it's a lifelong condition. So it doesn't ever go away that we know of. We've never seen a case that spontaneously disappears. You can have long periods of remission, but it never goes away. So as long as you have the disease, it's probably in your best interest to be on a treatment that prevents an attack. The average relapse rate is about every 7 to 15 months. Certainly, we've seen remissions that last longer than that, even off treatment. But if you have the disease, we recommend being on a drug. So that means staying on whatever medication works for you. And if you're on something that works for you and you go 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, it doesn't mean that your disease has disappeared. It just means it's in remission because of the medication. And so it makes no sense to stop it if it's working for you. Now, the one exception I make to that is azathioprine. I don't like that medicine because it can cause certain cancers. And Cellcept or mycophenolate was developed to address this issue. And so for most of my patients on azathioprine, I think almost everyone, I have switched them. So they don't come off of azathioprine to nothing. They switch from azathioprine to mycophenolate or to something else. Because that medication, although it's most widely available and one of the first ones studied in NMO, in my opinion, the risks, especially related to cancer, don't outweigh the benefits. So I recommend other treatments.
Also, I'll add in that in studies that we've done here, looking at the effectiveness of mycophenolate versus rituximab versus azathioprine, the azathioprine seems to be less effective than the other two. And so that just further supports that other therapies might be better options. And there are lots of therapies on the horizon as well. There are 3 clinical trials currently being recruiting. Using different mechanisms, all 3 very different mechanisms, one similar to rituximab. And a lot of them are very good options for patients, but they really need to, the decision to be in a trial needs to be tailored to the patient and, you know, all the circumstances surrounding that patient and their disease. But we're very excited since none of the other previous treatments, mycophenolate, rituximab, azathioprine, have been FDA approved for use in NMO. And so this gives patients a lot more options, hopefully in the near future.
Great. Yeah, thank you for that information. And for those listening, there's more information about the studies currently happening on myelitis.org as well, where you can see what's currently recruiting and the options available. So thank you for the overview about the different medications. We did get a question about how often someone should have a follow-up MRI or, if these are necessary, just to monitor, to see the progression and stuff. So if you could just talk a little bit about the protocol for kind of follow-up MRIs over time.
Generally, the attacks in NMO as compared to MS are very fulminant, very aggressive. Usually, not always. And so as a result, there's usually a clinical manifestation. And so we really don't get routine MRIs to look for new disease activity so much as when a patient reports new symptoms, we get an MRI then. So that differentiates it from multiple sclerosis, where we know there's a lot of disease for which there are not clinical correlates, and so we tend to get MRIs more often in MS to track the disease, whereas in NMO, we know that if patients are on their medications and not having clinical symptoms, that can't be blamed on an old attack, then we know that they are likely not having new activation of their immune system causing more damage.
Okay, thank you. And you know, we did get some questions too, kind of about the long-term prognosis or about recovery. And so one question came in that was about, you know, considering today's advancement in treatment, which we've talked about, you know, what is the prognosis for someone diagnosed with NMO in their 50s? And then also just in general, what's the overall prognosis of, you know, being diagnosed with NMO?
The prognosis that was published in the late 1990s used a mortality rate of something like 32%. And people still quote that number, but it doesn't apply anymore. We've had lots of studies in the preventive treatments that put patients in remission permanently. And what we know about NMO is that if you don't have a relapse, you'll never be worse than you currently are. In fact, you could get better. So the mortality rates have precipitously dropped, but there's also morbidity, which is neurological dysfunction. Being in a wheelchair, being blind, these are valid concerns. And again, what we know about NMO is that as long as you can prevent a relapse, then you won't accrue any more damage. As I mentioned in the introduction, we still have a lot of work to do on healing patients after an attack. So a lot of their prognosis depends on how much damage was done. And if we could influence the healing process, we could probably help our patients a lot more than just preventing the next attack. But that's something that we're working on in the laboratory.
Okay, and then is there anything different about MOG-positive NMO in terms of prognosis or disease course? We did get a question about that as well.
MOG positivity refers to a blood test that is similar to the aquaporin 4 blood test we use for NMO. And this blood test is not commercially available in the United States yet. What we know about it is that about 25-27% of patients with a disease that looks like NMO but tests negative for the aquaporin 4 antibody, so they test negative for the NMO antibody, about 25-27% of those patients will test positive for the MOG antibody. MOG is M-O-G. And that antibody predicts a somewhat similar course of disease. We think it predicts relapse in more than half of cases. And we think that it predicts a predominant attack of optic neuritis, recurrent optic neuritis. And most of these patients end up recovering fairly well as compared to the aquaporin 4 positive patients. But other than that, we don't know that much more about MOG compared to NMO. It's something that's a very active area of research, especially after the commercially available test becomes available in the US. We'll be testing a lot more patients for it, and I think we'll have a better understanding of the disease.
Okay, and so, and since I know you said that MOG positive patients tend to have more optic neuritis issues, we did get a question about how frequently someone should do a retinal fiber thickness test. Are there any other specific tests that are recommended for someone who has MOG positive NMO?
Yeah, I wish I could answer that. I'm not sure that there have been many studies, longitudinal studies of MOG patients yet, where we follow someone over time in order to understand what we need to do for them to either prevent attacks or to optimize the healing process. We really don't know. If we extrapolate from the NMO literature, what we think is that the attacks are what mediate the damage. And so if you don't have an attack, things should be fairly stable. But we don't know that for sure because some of the pathology of MOG overlaps with multiple sclerosis, and multiple sclerosis does have a progressive phase. So could it be that MOG patients have some progressive disease over time and need to be monitored imaging of the retina, for example, or is it going to be more like NMO, where all of the damage occurs through relapses and nothing happens in between? So we don't know the answer to that yet, but stay tuned. This is a very active area of research.
Okay, great, thank you. And then, so, you know, there are some diagnostic tests that can be used to diagnose NMO. And we got one question about an abnormal VEP in conjunction with a spinal lesion that's long, so it's from C4 to C8. Is this, would this be considered NMO, or what diagnostic tests or criteria are used to diagnose NMO?
Well, the diagnosis of NMO is based on evidence of inflammation in the spinal cord and optic nerve, especially in the context of an aquaporin 4 antibody in the bloodstream. And so that's really the crux of the disease. Now, for patients who test negative, is that what you were asking about patients who test negative?
Yes.
For the aquaporin 4
well,
test?
So yeah, so this person didn't specify, but yeah, if someone tests negative, you know, what are the criteria that are then used
yeah.
to diagnose NMO?
When they test negative, we always want to be sure we're not missing something like multiple sclerosis. There are many FDA-approved drugs for multiple sclerosis, and we don't want to deny an MS patient an approved drug if that's what they actually have. There are other diseases like neurosarcoidosis and others that may have more appropriate treatments as well. So most of our criteria for patients who test negative are to try to identify whether or not they actually have a different disease that can be more appropriately treated. So the threshold is a little bit higher. We look for two attacks. So evidence of a relapsing disease separated by at least 3 months. For example, one attack of optic neuritis in the optic nerve and one attack of transverse myelitis in the spinal cord separated by 3 months. That doesn't necessarily meet the criteria. There are a few other things we want to exclude, like multiple sclerosis, and we use a brain MRI to do that. And spinal cord MRI is helpful to measure the length of the spinal cord lesion. So it is a little bit of a complicated process to make the diagnosis of NMO in a patient who tests negative. It's much, much easier to make the diagnosis when someone tests positive. The threshold is much lower and much simpler criteria.
And then, you know, we got a question about, so people are on medication, you know, for the long term to prevent new attacks. Do we know what the likely causes of a breakthrough attack are, you know, after someone's been attack-free for 6 years on CellCept? Do we know kind of what causes these breakthrough attacks to occur?
We don't know for sure. Again, anything that activates the immune system has the potential to trigger an attack. So I think the most potent triggers are infections. They could be urinary tract infections. In one of our studies, we profiled a large group of patients who had relapses, and 30% of them had a urinary tract infection. That doesn't mean all urinary tract infections are going to trigger a relapse. But things like the flu can trigger a relapse. Even something as seemingly benign as a vaccine, if a patient is not currently treated, can trigger a relapse. So we know we have case series and reports of patients who have attacks in response to all kinds of infections and immune activating triggers. But again, we don't know which ones are necessarily going to trigger a relapse. We just see them as a risk. We encourage all of our patients to avoid, trying to stay as clean as possible to avoid getting infections. We actually encourage the flu vaccination for patients who are on treatment, like rituximab. It's safe to get the flu vaccine because that will avoid the flu infection. And then using Purell, those hand sanitizers on your hands when dealing with kids, may help avoid any kind of infection that you can get from them.
Okay. And then, you know, how can someone tell whether they're having a recurrence or they're just experiencing new symptoms? For example, This person said that their MRI shows no new damage, but they have additional spasticity and weakness that they didn't have previously. How does someone then determine that this is indeed a recurrence or just a worsening of symptoms from something else?
It's a very good question. We spend half our days trying to differentiate between new events and old manifestations, old symptoms from old events. And just like Dr. Levy mentioned that urinary tract infections can trigger new events, they certainly are also a huge causative element for having old symptoms resurface. And the importance, of course, in differentiating between which is what is that you want to be able to A, know if a patient is having a new attack and is not appropriately being treated, and then you want to acutely treat that attack. And so there can be a lot of miscommunication about what's an attack, and it really is something that's is caused by immune activation. And so So when patients do re-experience old events, if they are similar, usually milder, but similar to old events, old attack symptoms they once had, such as weakness in a certain part of the body, increase in pain, increase in spasticity, those types of things oftentimes are attributable to the old damage that is being resurfaced because of some metabolic or infectious agent that's causing disruption in the body. And so really digging through and trying to decide what could be causing these symptoms. Now, of course, if a patient with NMO had only transverse myelitis in the past and has a new optic neuritis, comes to us and says that she's blind in an eye, then we know pretty well, without even having to image her, that this is a new event. So that's not related to any old damage since there was never prior damage to the optic nerve. And so it's really kind of a little bit of an art, as much as it is a science in terms of the differentiation. But whenever we're in doubt, we just get an MRI to really verify whether there's a new event going on that needs to be treated or not.
Right. Okay. And then we did a question about pregnancy in NMO. You know, is pregnancy possible? You know, how does medication kind of play into all of that? And, you know, what are the dangers for the patient and also, the child?
Yeah, the question of pregnancy is important because most of our patients with NMO are female. And they tend to be in the childbearing years in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And what we know about NMO is that in the first and second trimester, there's basically no increased risk of a relapse in the mom due to NMO. But in the third trimester, there may be a slight increased risk. And certainly postpartum, those first 6 months after the baby's born, there's a high risk of relapse in the mom, fourfold over the baseline risk. And we think medications can mitigate that risk. Things like Rituxan, which you may be on already, can help reduce that risk. But there's also a big question about what to use as a preventive medication during pregnancy. Mycophenolate or Celcept there's a big black box warning from the FDA that Celcept is definitely harmful to the fetus. It causes facial deformities like cleft lip and cleft palate in about 7% of patients. So we definitely don't want our young ladies getting pregnant on mycophenolate. That would be the worst thing that could happen. Azathioprine is class D, which D as in dog, which is not good evidence and something that we're not really happy with. Again, azathioprine poses cancer risks in addition. So we don't usually use azathioprine, but I do know that patients in other countries where azathioprine is widely available, they will often get pregnant on azathioprine and there are some good outcomes there. So it's not necessarily harmful, but it's something that we don't use routinely in the US. Rituximab seems to be kind of the safest option. Some patients try to time it so they get an infusion of rituximab, and then the half-life is 2 weeks, so about two or three half-lives later, 6 weeks later, they try to get pregnant then because the medication is no longer in their body, and then they'll deliver and then get their next infusion of Rituxan. We all know it's very difficult to try to plan pregnancies like that. Some women do it and some women can't. And some of our patients will get the rituximab infusion during pregnancy. We've had several successful cases that way. And we know that the fetus will be exposed to the rituximab, and that's okay. The baby will be born without B cells, just like the mom. And that seems to be safe, at least in the United States. The baby will then make its own B cells in a year or a year and a half. And it doesn't seem to pose any increased risk even at daycare. So as far as we know, rituximab is probably the safest approach for NMO treatment during pregnancy.
Okay, and then what about if an attack does occur during pregnancy? Are the standard kind of acute therapies used in pregnant women, or are there additional precautions with that?
Yeah, we definitely use high-dose steroids. Plasma exchange is a little bit more murky during pregnancy because with plasma exchange, you take out quite a large volume, about a half a liter of blood at a time to filter it. And that that amount of blood coming in and out can cause volume shifts in the placenta. And so we're a little bit nervous about it. Not that we can't do plasma exchange during pregnancy, but it's definitely something we have to consider and think through before we just treat with plasma exchange.
Right. Okay. We have talked a little bit about rituximab. So one of the questions is that this person has been on rituximab gotten an infusion every 6 months for the last 5 years. And they said that their B cell count remains at or near zero. But at around 5 months in, they start to feel worse. And so they are wondering if it makes sense to move the treatment up sooner to every 5 months as opposed to every six, or is every 6 months pretty standard?
Well, what's standard is to keep the B cells at zero. So it doesn't matter whether you need it every 5 months or 6 months or 7 months. The goal is to keep it at zero. But one thing I wanted to emphasize is that if your B cell counts start to bump up, it's not that you'll feel worse. It's that the risk of an attack goes up. So when your B cells start to climb, it doesn't mean that you're going to even feel it or notice it. It just means that instead of a 10 or 20% risk of an attack, you're now going up 25, 30, 35% risk of an attack. But again, it doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to have an attack. It's just an increased risk. Patients shouldn't notice when they're getting towards the end of their B cell, the rituximab life. And if they are, I wonder if there are other things going on, any other symptoms or treatments that can be offered that are not related to the immunological part of NMO.
I'll also add that if patients have an awareness that their B cells are coming up, that also gives them a lot of anxiety. So in addition to them being at greater risk for a relapse, it also can elicit old symptoms. So they can start to feel crummy because of the anxiety associated with their blood cell, with their B cells rising.
Right. Okay. And then we did talk a little bit about stem cell therapy, and I know this is largely talked about in terms of the spinal cord, but can stem cells also be used in the optic nerve or for optic neuritis, or has stuff primarily been studied in the spinal cord and brain?
Up to now, most of the studies have been in spinal cord injury, mostly because animal models, like in rats and mice, lend themselves well for spinal cord surgery, and the optic nerves in these animals are very tiny for injections. But having said that, the tissue is thought to maybe be similar in terms of how well they would respond to regeneration from stem cells, and So if we actually get to that point where we're ready to transplant, I think the optic nerves and the spinal cord would be equal targets in terms of their potential for recovery.
Okay. And then just moving on to symptoms and recovery, we did get one question. This person was diagnosed with NMO about 2 years ago, and they complete paraplegia and bowel and bladder dysfunction. And so, what is the chance of recovery after a diagnosis like this? And, how do symptoms kind of progress over time or get better or worse?
Generally, most of the healing after an attack occurs in the first 6 months. There is more healing taking place after that. And it also depends on the age of the person and how much damage was done. But after 2 years of having no improvement, I certainly wouldn't promise anything wonderful after that. It's a devastating disease and it causes some permanent damage. Having said that, of course, in the lab, we're working towards trying to regenerate tissue. So, for all of my young patients out there who are in wheelchairs, I always say, hang on, because it won't be that much longer until stem cells are going to be tested in NMO and in transverse myelitis and in optic neuritis. And I still think the potential for recovery is there. It just depends on us working out the science and making sure that it's a safe and effective treatment.
Okay. And then we did get a few questions actually about pain. So why does neuropathic pain happen in NMO, and kind of what are the best treatments or medications that are used for nerve pain?
Well, right now we use the same treatments that are used in multiple sclerosis, which are mostly anti-epileptics, antidepressants, and anti-spasm medications, and depending on the type of pain that patients are experiencing. We know that this is one of the most severe and most debilitating symptoms that patients refer to, and we don't have great treatments, so we know that these same medications that we're using work pretty well in multiple sclerosis, and at least half of patients with pain and MS tend to be pain-free in response to these medications, but with similar regimens, NMO patients are not as responsive. And so there really is a need to explore options outside of medications for pain. It's a direct result of the damage from the inflammatory attack that damages the spinal thalamus, certain tracts in the spinal cord that cause pain. And so but actually oftentimes it happens months out from the attack. So at first you have a lot of numbness and lack of sensation. And then over time, as your body is beginning to heal, it inappropriately interprets sensory information and you experience pain. And so we know that there's an evolution of pain from the acute to the subacute to the chronic phase of an attack, and that it's really very severe and long-lasting and maybe under-recognized or under-appreciated sometimes, but it's, I think, something we're getting better about asking and trying to treat. So right now, as I said, we mostly use these medications, and oftentimes using more than one that have different mechanisms of action can help to curb the pain. We try to reset expectations such that patients don't expect to be pain-free, but to have a pain at a level that's tolerable for them and still enables them to do their daily activities. And so we really want for people to not necessarily with those with very severe pain, we don't want the expectation to be that they'll be completely pain-free. And so it's a little bit of a lot of experimentation, and regimens are very different, and response is very different by patient. But again, this is where we earlier mentioned some of these non-pharmacologic interventions, and I think utilizing them in conjunction with medications is a smart idea.
Okay. And then We've talked a little bit about, you know, people who are seronegative versus positive. Are there any differences between, you know, the symptoms people experience based on, you know, whether they're positive for aquaporin 4 or MOG versus not, you know, like in terms of severity of expected symptoms or prognosis?
We don't have enough data to answer that question. There are some preliminary studies, like one out of Japan, that suggest that MOG patients have a better outcome in terms of their ability to heal after an attack and to recover. But then a MOG patient group out of Germany suggested that may not be the case. So we don't have the answer to that question yet. It's certainly not worse than aquaporin 4 patients. So MOG and aquaporin 4 are either similar or maybe MOG has a slightly better outcome. That could be due to the fact that MOG, which stands for myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein, the target is on myelin. And when you damage myelin, you can heal from that. As opposed to aquaporin 4, which attacks astrocytes, it kills brain tissue, and the neurons will die as a result. It may be that that mechanism explains why MOG patients can heal better. But again, until we really have good data from enough patients, we can't say for sure.
Right. And what about, you know, is there differences between patients, you know, if we don't think about MOG, but in terms of patients who are aquaporin 4 positive versus negative, in terms of prognosis or severity of symptoms?
Well, so right now we know that all those MOG patients are grouped in with the seronegative, aquaporin 4 seronegative patients, so it's a little hard to differentiate independent of MOG, but there have been studies that suggest that their disability is similar in NMO, in seropositive and seronegative patients.
Okay. And then just to go back a little bit to treatment for nerve pain, I know we talked some about the medications. Are narcotics ever prescribed for nerve pain, or, you know, what type of medicine is used for nerve pain?
Well, narcotics aren't a standard of care at Hopkins. I know some places feel differently about this, and some patients, particular patients, we will try that approach, but we really think those that quiet the nerves, like the anti-epileptics and the such as gabapentin, for example, or pregabalin or carbamazepine, or the antidepressants like amitriptyline or Cymbalta, have better target that type of pain better. And so it is our first approach. It's a frustrating approach because the response isn't immediate. It takes weeks sometimes for some of these medications to become therapeutic and to really for you to have response, particularly because we need to titrate up slowly to reduce the risk of you having adverse events or having fatigue or any kind of symptoms that really make, you know, the treatment worse than the original ailment. And so it's a really frustrating process, and so it requires a lot of patience, and narcotics are a quicker thing to use, but they tend to be also not very effective, and they tend to cause a lot of fatigue as well that really inhibit other, you know, a person's ability to really interact in a meaningful way in other aspects of their life. And so we don't take lightly putting patients on medications, but on narcotic medications, but I won't say that it's not done. It's just not the first thing. It's not our go-to.
Right. Okay. And then we also talked a little bit about B cells and measuring B cells. So we did get one question about this person is negative for aquaporin 4 antibody, and so they were asking what blood test is used, you know, best used to measure B cells, and how often should these be monitored?
For patients who are on Rituxan, it doesn't matter if you test positive for the aquaporin 4 antibody. The test that we measure for Rituxan is a B cell marker called CD19, C as in cat, D as in dog, CD19. And it's just a marker of B cells. So that's how we can tell what cell is a B cell and what cell is not a B cell. And the goal is to reduce B cells from the bloodstream to zero. We don't want any B cells floating around in the bloodstream. The rest of the B cells in the body are living and doing their job, surveilling tissues, but we keep them out of the bloodstream with rituximab. So we usually measure CD19 counts or B cell counts once per month for patients who are just starting rituximab. And then once we verify that the B cells remain at zero throughout the course of the 6 months before their next infusion, then we don't have to check every time. And we know that patients' B cell counts basically, they work the same way every 6 months. And so if they're at zero in month one and in month five, then that's what we're happy with. And then they can just stay on rituximab every 6 months after that. There is another B cell marker called CD27, which is not as widely used. It can be used, but the numbers are so low that even in patients who have normal B cell counts, the numbers are low and we don't know necessarily what the threshold should be. So CD19 is a more accurate measure and they should be at zero. While you're on Rituxan. For patients who are not on Rituxan, if they're on CellCept or something else, there are other tests we use to monitor the effectiveness of their medications that are not CD19 B cell counts.
Okay. And then we did get one question about dysphagia or trouble swallowing. Is there any treatments for this besides breathing treatments, or is this something that will go away or just continue to get worse in a moment?
Well, outside of a relapse, we don't expect anything to necessarily get worse. Once the damage is done and the inflammation is gone, we don't expect things to get worse. There are a few exceptions to that. Most of the time, things get better, slowly but surely get better. And after a few months, 6 to 12 months maybe, whatever you're left with is probably where you're going to live for the next few years. And so if the relapse that you're talking about took place more than a year or two ago and the trouble with swallowing is still there, then I'd be worried about that's damage. There are means to dealing with that. There are techniques, for example, for how to make people swallow better that physical therapists and occupational therapists and speech swallowing pathologists can help you with. So there are kind of non-medical ways of dealing with swallowing problems.
Okay. And then do we know anything about, whether someone who has been diagnosed with NMO, if they're more likely to get, a second or third autoimmune disease or disorder, and, are they related to each other? And, how are the differences between the effects of NMO or, another autoimmune disease determined?
Well, we do know that there's a lot of overlap with other antibodies associated with other autoimmune diseases, such as Sjogren's disease and lupus, to name just a couple. And but most of those diseases don't affect the central nerve. Those diseases don't by themselves affect the central nervous system. And so they're related, but not the same. And so a lot of times patients with NMO will ask if their joint pain is a result of the NMO directly. And most often it's associated with one of these other rheumatologic diseases or with, wear and tear on the joints, but that's separate. But assuming that it is something kind of autoimmune related, it's something else other than NMO. So we know NMO really is limited to the central nervous system. It also overlaps, though, with another neurologic disease, myasthenia gravis. And the rates of overlap with these diseases, these types of diseases, is more significant or higher than in MS. But MS also overlaps with some of these diseases, and yet MS and NMO do not overlap.
Right. Okay. And then, you know, so we did get a question too about if there's any specialized center in Europe that you're aware of, but I'd like to kind of extend that question a little broader about if someone doesn't necessarily have access to, you know, like at Hopkins, the, you know, TMNMO center, what kind of physician or healthcare provider should they see? Is there a particular specialty, or, you know, what would you recommend for someone who doesn't necessarily have access to, you know, a specialized center if they have NMO?
Well, the most common neuroimmunologic disease is multiple sclerosis. So somebody with expertise in multiple sclerosis will usually have some background or some understanding of NMO as well. And so for patients who don't have access to, you know, NMO or TM specific doctors, that would be our recommendation, to see somebody who specializes in multiple sclerosis.
Okay, that makes sense. And then, so you did talk a little bit about MS and NMO. Is there any sort of, do we know of any kind of genetic relationship between them? So this person has a cousin that has MS, but they have NMO.
I think that that's one of the most exciting areas of research. We're collecting DNA samples now to try to understand what the family histories are of patients with NMO. We certainly notice an increased prevalence of autoimmune diseases like lupus and Sjogren's and multiple sclerosis, but we don't understand why. We think that there is a genetic predisposition that precedes some sort of environmental trigger. But beyond that, we don't know the answer. So if we have patients out there on the phone and on the webcast who are listening who have multiple family members with NMO, we need your blood. And we need your DNA to understand this link. But I don't have more information at the moment.
Okay, and that's a great transition actually to a question we got about what someone can do to help further research other than, you know, donating money to different research institutions. So, what else can someone do to help further research to make sure research is being done?
Well, we have several ways. One is to donate blood and other samples like DNA and data. There's a nationwide repository. I think there are about 20 sites in the U.S. that are participating. And all of these sites share blood and data without revealing the identity of the patient. We have all the clinical data, but we strip the name and date of birth out of everything. So your privacy is protected and assured, but it's a way that we can all work with a rare disease without all having access to hundreds and hundreds of patients and samples. And that program is called the CIRCLES program, CIRCLES Repository. It's sponsored by the Guthrie Jackson Charitable Foundation. And so if you want to do anything, that's probably the easiest thing to do and the most helpful. Patients can also participate in clinical trials. We need answers to whether these new drugs are going to be effective. And so for patients who in whom a trial is appropriate, participating is also very helpful to the field in general.
And actually, in addition to clinical trials, there's also always research being done that is a little less labor intensive for patients, surveys and things like that. We have things like that going on pretty much at every moment in time. And then there's also on the horizon, hopefully, some symptom management trials as well in NMO that you know, so that we can expand beyond just looking at the disease process itself, but also the damage that has accrued as a result.
Yes, and so, and as I mentioned previously, the TMA does have several, you know, clinical trials listed on our website, and we also have a registry as well that's just a survey that people can take online, just talking about their symptoms, their onset, and treatment they received, and kind of their current symptoms as well. So yes, there are many ways to participate in research, thankfully. So we are getting towards the end of our time. Is there anything in particular that, you know, we didn't talk about that you think is important to note at this point?
No, I think you've been very thorough, and I think these questions that patients have sent us are very good and very insightful.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, we did cover a lot of topics, so we want to thank you very much for your time, and I want to just remind everyone that this recording will be made available on our website and also via iTunes, and thank you both very much for joining us today. It was a great conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.